Broadsword calling Danny Boy. Come in, Danny Boy. Hello, and welcome to episode 188 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other heroic war people. There's probably a name for that. soldiers? Yeah, okay. As masterpieces, I am Nick. I am the Welsh baritone of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Manly grunt.
Yeah. And we are, we're Alistair McLeaning it up today. McLean? It's McLean, isn't it?
McLean, yes.
In that we are doing some war films, but not just any war films, they are Alistair McLean war films.
Well, yeah, this happened more or less by accident. I think we talked about Where Eagles Dare first as one of the classic shown repeatedly on bank holidays sort of films.
Yes.
And Guns and Other Own, similarly to a lesser extent, and I realised, hang on, these are both actually McLean, and they're sort of opposite, more or less opposite ends of the 60s. So, have you read McLean, by the way?
I have not. I was looking into him for this podcast. So, for me, I grew up, exactly as you say, with, somehow I avoided ever seeing the Guns of Never Own when I was a kid, but Where Eagles Dare was a staple for me. It was one of those films that got me into a Christmassy mood. So I just watched it around Christmas. So I sort of, it's one of those weird films where I know it very well, but haven't really watched it objectively for a long time. But no, I've never read any of his works.
I've got to say, towards the end, he really went off, as sadly many writers do. But he definitely had a style which worked, and it can be very enjoyable. And we're going to see Two sides of that, I think, with these, because one of the things he was known for in later years was extremely twisty plots.
Okay, yes.
But honestly, that's not what we get here in the Guns of Never Own.
No, so Guns of Never Own, I mean, there's certainly some other things that I found similarities between the film. It's 1961. Mm-hmm. So not super long after the end of the Second World War.
Well, yeah, that's the thing I want to come back to. But basically, at this point, you can get people on the crew who know what it actually looks like,
right?
And yes, in some cases, as in The Longest Day, one of the senior generals is played by a guy who was one of his junior officers in the actual event, but. The thing is that most of the people who were actually there aren't in the audience because they've seen that. They've seen the real thing. They don't want to see more of it.
Yes.
And well, I think gradually over this decade it gets more and more. Some of them you get the real operation, like The Longest Day, the Bridget Remagen. And it gradually gets more and more fantastical.
Well, I have to say, so I come from, I guess my adult war film watching, such that it has been more kind of graphic and, I don't know so much about realistic, but certainly more grim depictions of war probably is more realistic. So coming back to these more, both these films feel like the kind of cinematic equivalent of Commando comics. in that they're very, I'm not saying that disparagingly. I guess what I mean is I had to get in the right mindset to see them because yeah. They're very boy's own adventure. Not that they glorify war, particularly either of them.
But for example, MOOCs, but well before Hong Kong cinema invented the idea.
Yes, particularly in Where Eagles Dare. So, The Guns of Never Own is set on a fictional Mediterranean, Greek island.
Yeah.
And the idea is that these huge, you would know better than me, but these huge battleship killer guns that basically will destroy anything that goes past them, owned by the Axis, by the Germans. I don't know if the Italians are in there. I'm not sure what stage of the war this is. I think it's quite late on in the war.
I think we're in that. That bit of the Italian history that the Italians don't like to talk about.
Yes. So, there is a group of British soldiers, kind of Dunkirk-like, trying to evacuate from a Mediterranean island further in, and they're all going to get killed.
And this is a thing that I think, I suppose you could call it, you know, it's too much info dumping at the start, but I kind of like it because if you do know anything about military procedures of the era, you would obviously say, well, why don't we do it with this or this or this? And they run through all the alternatives and say, well, no, we can't because, you know, it's under this extremely thick rock shelf. If we get a low level, well, the guys just coming back from the attempt at doing it low level have brought back about half their planes and fewer than half their men. This is the only option left.
I mean, the reason I was on board with it is because it's James Roberts and Justice doing the voiceover.
Well, yes.
And so that helps a huge amount.
Makes everything more convincing.
It does, yeah. There's just sort of, I don't know, I would sort of salute him were he here right now. Just something about him that has a natural... His mere name, Justice, just he should either be a judge or an admiral. There's no other possibility for who he should be. But, yes, yeah, so we get this voiceover setting up the story, but... Basically, they need to get them rescued by sea within, I think it's a week, within 8 days, because otherwise the Germans are on their way to basically go and slaughter everyone on the island. I think it's just that they're not going to be captured, they're going to be murdered, as I recall.
Well, it's kind of a fine distinction when there's a major assault going on.
True, but either way, they need to get out quick, so someone... needs to neutralise these giant battleship destroying guns, because the battleships are on their way, because they have to be, so someone's got to get there first, destroy the guns, or one, the ships will all be sunk on the way, and everyone on the island will be killed / captured. So that, as far as a plot goes, it sets it up really quickly, really nicely, you know what's at stake, you know what's going to happen, so actually, to me, the overall plot from there does go through some twists and turns, but actually it's not super twisty-turny, the story. It's just this motley group of people.
Led by Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck. See, this film is full of people that I'm quite happy to see on the screen. My history of Ribbon and Memes is that I don't know why, but I do quite like films about groups of men being manly together, like in Jaws and Das Boot and The Man Who Would Be King. I don't know why, it's just something that stirs something in me, which is good because there's very few women in this film, but there are some.
There are no women in the book.
Oh, really? Okay, so they put... Okay. Gregory Peck is a... his special skill, because you've all got to have a thing in these sorts of films. So Gregory Peck's thing is he can climb good. He can climb real good.
Mallory in the book is a New Zealander, which is obviously calling out to Edward Hillary.
Right, yes. He's even got a similar name, hasn't he? Yeah, who had recently climbed Everest?
Yeah.
Was it in the 50s?
I think so. I mean, I may just be making this up, but...
No, that makes sense to me. If you're thinking of a climbing man... in the early 60s, a New Zealander.
May of 53.
Okay, yeah. So that's probably calling out to it. But, of course, him being Gregory Peck, he is an American. He is, though, he's one of those characters that I just... he's sort of the opposite of Steve McQueen in a way to me. Seeing him on the film makes me relaxed and reassured. It does speak to the kind of character. With Gregory Peck, I expect a kind of, a bit like a Henry Fonda before he subverted it with Once Upon a Time in the West. You expect a sort of man with moral standards and integrity. He does undercut that a bit here because he does what he has to in the name of war.
But then, it's also interesting to see that we've previously seen him in On the Beach, which is made 2 years earlier. Here he looks a lot younger and less tired, so that's presumably acting. Well done.
I was assuming On the Beach was way later than this. I knew it was black and white, but that doesn't mean a lot in this era. Wow. Okay. Didn't think of that. So then the rest of the Motley crew include David Niven, who the only other film, obviously I'm aware of David Niven, and obviously I like him. but I was only seen him as an actor in, I think, the original Pink Panther film. And maybe, is he in Casino Royale?
Yes.
Not that one, the other one.
He's in the original Casino Royale, yeah.
The very bizarre one.
the one that Peter Sellers did his best to sabotage, yeah.
Yes. I think it's kind of self-sabotage. Anyway, but he is a kind of explosive expert here. That's his thing. But he's also, I think he's a really interesting character because he's the one that is kind of sick of it all and doesn't get, what I like, he gets a few speeches. I found him mesmerizing, but he gets a few speeches where basically he just doesn't give a shit anyway. He just wants the war to finish. He doesn't care who wins. He keeps getting told the thing he does is vital to the war effort. And it isn't. And loads of his friend died when he did. I really like his, he's cynical, but chipper about it as well.
Well, a thing he is said to have said while actually in the war, look, you chaps only have to do this once. I'm going to have to do it all over again in Hollywood with Errol Flynn.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. A lot of these, a lot of the actors were actually in the war. I believe Gregory Peck, was he?
I don't know the details, but Niven made a point of saying, you know, lots of people are talking about what they did. I've been to the graveyards. I don't think I did anything any more special than they did. I don't want to brag about it, basically.
So that's that kind of humility is what we respond to in Britain, for sure. So that's good. We have Anthony Quayle, who I think we last saw in Lawrence of Arabia, probably.
Probably, yeah.
He's a slightly odd one in that he always seems to sort of slight, despite him being very famous in a lot of famous films, he always slightly fades in the background for me. I don't know why. Maybe he's with all these other characters as well. It took me ages to place Stanley Baker, who is, so I knew him, but I couldn't work who it was until I finally looked him up. Of course, he's the Zulu, the main, captain in Zulu. But here he's kind of his thing is he's a knife guy. I love that they've all got a thing. It just keeps it simple. So he's the knife guy.
Well, do bear in mind that in the book it makes it easy to keep track of them.
So we've got the explosives guy, the climbing guy, the knifey guy, the face guy, who's James Darren, who he feels like the kind of Frankie Avalon of the cast. He's the one to put in to attract the younger teenage audience. maybe I'm wrong there, but he's the Greek, man who's there out for vengeance. We also get early on in the film a very early appearance by Richard Harris with possibly, with the exception of Leonard Nimoy in a TV show I watched once, possibly the worst Australian accent I've ever seen in my life.
There's competition for that. I mean, I won't say where some of that competition might have come from, but...
Hey, I haven't tried Australia. Never went to Australia in mass.
There's another almost Ruben Amin connection here, because this was almost directed by Alexander McKendrick, who made Sweet Smell of Success.
Very different films.
he left just before filming started. Officially, it was illness. There is a strong suggestion that the producers were not happy with the way he was going to put it together. Replaced by J. Lee Thompson, whom I know from Ice Cold and Alex, which is 3 years earlier.
Is that another Alistair MacLean?
It is not, but it wouldn't surprise one if it were.
Right. Okay. Basically, I've never seen that.
A motley crew is taking an ambulance across the desert to try to get back to friendly territory, and they pick up someone, and can he be trusted, and that kind of thing. But also with Anthony Quayle, so.
Wait, I have seen Ice Cold in Alex. That's the one where it ends in the... And he picks up the beer, and it looks like the greatest beer you've ever drunk in your whole life. I was thinking of Ice Station Zebra, which I haven't
seen. That is MacLean.
Oh, there we go.
I haven't seen the film of it, though.
So, they have got to hire a rickety sailboat. Do they hire it? They just buy it, I think. A rickety sailboat.
One would hope, given what happens to it.
Because they can't be caught. They've got this is a Nazi-occupied island. They've got to sail across, climb up a cliff. That's where Climbing Man comes in. Get to the guns.
Yeah, one of the reasons this is considered to be possible at all is that everybody knows this cliff is unclimbable.
Not if you're a Gregory Peck, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So they're on route, they meet a Nazi patrol boat, and they just kill them all.
That's the thing I find is interesting, because in quite a lot of this style of film, I mean, obviously there are some beats you kind of expected to hit. Quite a lot of them, you get the tension of are they going to manage to pass their masquerade or not?
Yeah.
And we start with that, but then, all of a sudden, no, let's just shoot everybody.
Yes, except they sort of pretend for about 5 minutes, just basically so they can get in position to murder them all, which they do. They just kill everyone on the ship. We haven't mentioned Anthony Quinn, of course. I don't know if we've seen him in A Ribbon of Memes before, but he is the angry Greek chap whose wife was killed, and he's promised to kill Gregory Peck as soon as the war is over. That's his thing. He's angry. Angry and Greek. He's got two things.
Because, obviously, they're not in any way going to reconcile.
That was a slightly disappointing. The minute he said that at the beginning of the film, you know that's not going to happen. Either Anthony Quinn would die, but unlikely, or that will get sorted out. So they kill everyone on the Nazi ship. They go through a horrendous storm, but they make it. The ship is wrecked on the coast of Navarone, and then they climb up the cliff, all except poor Anthony Quinn, who ballses himself up quite badly on the way up. He falls down a sort of chimney shaft.
I do find this kind of interesting, having seen, you know, Halloween and some later horror films, and the idea of everybody gets killed one at a time. We're killing them off one at a time here to show people how high the stakes are.
Yes, yeah. Anthony Quinn, well, he doesn't quite die, much to the pain in the arse of everyone else. And Toby, it's a bit of a Captain Oates situation. Probably would have been better if they're going to finish him off. Just do it now instead of drag him halfway across the island and then do it. But being not quite compromised enough yet, I guess Gregory Peck chooses to carry him along on a stretcher. So then they trudge across.
I would like to say, though, that I do like the dialogue-free cliff-climbing sequence, but my goodness, it's a bit dark. I mean, it's meant yes. to be dark, obviously, but it's kind of hard to see what's going on. We're supposed to be able to see what's going on, I feel.
Yes, I agree. It's atmospheric, but yeah, I had to turn the brightness up. Let's put it that way. They knock off a few guards at the guard post at the top, which means they're on a time limit now, because sooner or later they're going to realise these guards aren't there anymore. So they've already been semi-compromised. They make it to, and here, it's not very convoluted, this one, but they make it to a fort. Is that what happens next?
Well, one of the things is that Franklin decides that he is a burden on the team and tries to kill himself.
Oh, yes.
Fortunately, he messes that up, not about as much as he messed up the climbing. But after that, we do get a fight with quite a few Nazis, and somehow they just break contact, and that I feel was the film just conveniently saying, "Oh well, now they're not going to fight anymore."
They escape into a cave, don't they?
This is the classic problem, of course, once the alert goes up, they should be facing bigger and bigger forces trying to hunt them down.
But they don't. They don't pursue them. They're like, oh, they've gone to a cave. Never mind. That's it. And that's kind of the end of that. You're right. They meet their resistance fighters, one of which is Frankie Avalon's sister. Yes, and a lady. And another lady who has been tortured by the Germans before and whipped to within an inch of her life, apparently. She can't even bear to show them the scars. But she's very enigmatic. Consequently, Frankie Avalon immediately fancies her. In fact, everyone fancies her, but Gregory Peck does as well. So the women, I don't know, they get some dialogue. It's not about other men. Does it pass the Bechdel test? I don't know if they ever talk to each other. In fact, I don't think she talks
think
at all,
so.
Anna. But never mind.
Yeah, that's her gimmick.
That's her thing, is yeah, she doesn't talk and she's escaped. I don't know what Maria's thing is. She's Frankie Avalon's sister, I guess. I can't think of him as anything
vengeance
else.
Driven. Frankie.
Vengeance driven. There we go.
I mean, every Greek we meet in this is vengeance driven, so.
Then they go to a town because
we filmed this wedding and we're going to use this footage, damn it.
It's not, I like it. It's interesting. Basically, because Franklin's got gangrene now, and they need to get him fixed or he's going to die. But it, well, they leave him with a doctor. They're pretty sure he's going to die anyway, but unfortunately, they get captured. Mm-hmm. No, Franklin gets captured. And they suddenly think, wait, they have the magic scopolamine, which is one of the themes of these, is that truth serum in Alistair MacLean novels works perfectly, I think. Mm-hmm. And that is not how any kind of truth serum works. It lowers your inhibitions, but you're probably already a bit low if you've got fever and gangrene, so I'm not sure.
What with all the pain and so on, yeah.
Yes. But anyway, they realise that... Mallory is very clever here, because what he does is whisper some bullshit and uses... this is where you start to see a bit of compromise in Gregory Peck's character, because he whispers some nonsense about what they're going to do.
A completely different plan in a completely different place.
Yes, I think he says they're going to land on the opposite coast to come and destroy the guns. So Mallory, of course... Franklin then, of course, spills all that to the Germans, and they escape.
Ah, but you're missing the key good Nazi, bad Nazi. I don't know if the first example of it on film, but it's certainly quite an early one. Because
this is when they get captured. All
yeah,
in the group,
we've got the
it?
Civilized guy who says, "Yes, of course, we'll give him medical treatment. Tell us what we need to know. We can make things go well.
He's the honourable, a man of honour.
While walking in front of his own men's guns, which is bad blocking, old chap. but then the bad Nazi turns up.
Now, is he SS or is he just a bad Nazi? I've got mixed up between that.
Well, it's been a very hot time since I've watched this film. He is certainly SS. I can't remember whether the other guy's meant to be as well, but he's definitely meant to be a bad SS.
He's a bad one, isn't he? Consequently, they just kill them all. They do a bit of bluffing. You wonder where it's going, but then basically Anthony Quinn, just wrestles the gun off one of them, and then they all murder them all and then escape. Except they leave the good Nazi alive and make sure he's going to be all right.
And obviously they leave Franklin behind because he does actually need the medical attention.
He does, actually, yes. So the Nazis are all deployed to the wrong side of the island, but here is another MacLean-esque twist. They realise that someone has been feeding the Nazis information the whole way. Because they couldn't have known, or that the Nazis have basically just been too lucky in finding them in the town and finding the doctor, and they piece it all together. And it turns out Anna, the escaped war criminal, is not escaped at all, and is revealed dramatically by her taking a top off. Not quite in a priorient way, but they realise.
I've got to say, this is a thing that could have been tested at any time.
Yes, exactly.
Without especially embarrassing her. I mean, it's war, it's tough.
Yeah, but Captain Mallory hadn't slept with her before then, so now he's done that, now we can reveal her as the enemy.
And do bear in mind, I mean, she is the woman who isn't played by Irene Pappas.
Yes, true. It's so, Gia Scala as Anna. She's opened up to Mallory the night before, in more ways than one. But the very
one might assume that. Obviously, there's nothing on the film to confirm or deny.
No. But they are in high tense situation. They reveal her completely unwhipped back, and it turns out that she was lying. She wasn't. She didn't escape from the prisoner of war camp. She was released as a Nazi spy. And Alistair MacLean's story, I don't know if it's a feature of all his stories, but there does seem to be double-crossing and
often
treachery. And so this is certainly a feature of the... And people sort of sick of war, but still having a jolly good time doing the war. We get some nice speeches here by David Niven about how it's... I really liked his character, this kind of cracked cynic in that he tries to cover it with humour, but he is actually quite sensitive and can't cope with it and is close to a nervous breakdown. But that's all right, because Mallory's quite prepared to execute Anna, but instead Maria does it to sort of save his morals. So she's finished off. We have the final stage of the plan. They've got to get to, well, they split off into groups. Several of them go to get a boat so they can escape. So they'll basically drive it under the boat, under the guns, so they can jump in. And meanwhile, Mallory, David Niven's character, does Maria go with them as well? Oh no, Maria and this is where. So the Greek kid, the Frankie Avalon, so they've been mowing through these MOOCs like nobody's business, but then it comes to the point where, oh, he's got to die now, so he just sort of lets himself die in a way. He just sort of stands out and gets shot to death.
Well, it's basically a Mexican standoff with submachine guns.
Yeah, it is a bit booked in Sundance. But they've been through situations like that before and made it, but it's plot relevant, so he has to pop off. Meanwhile, they infiltrate the bomb. It goes relatively smoothly from here. They go and they break into the fort. They shut the massive fort doors behind them so the Germans can't get back in.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. There is this very heavy armoured door to the gun cave. And there's an alarm that goes off when it's closed. Why would an alarm go off when it's closed?
Because the plot requires them to then get to the door and do everything they can to get through it. David Niven plants all the bombs, and...
They're essentially working on the basis that they can't really pick a timer interval. They do actually want to live, if possible.
Yes.
So they end up rigging a thing so when the shell hoist goes all the way to the bottom, it will complete the circuit and...
Yeah, it's fairly simple, but it works. But
while leaving some other charges on the guns themselves, to because that would be the obvious place to place them, so that when the garrison gets in, they will find that, and they, here is the problem.
We've got it. Meanwhile, poor old Stanley Baker, knife guy, turns out to be a rubbish knife guy. We've had this foreshadowed at some point that he got a bit nervous in the shootout, that's it, and didn't do his knifey thing. Well, here he finds, it's a bit Saving Private Ryan, actually. He finds a guy who he's got a knife. He doesn't knife him very well and gets killed. But Maria and Anthony Quayle, Anthony Quayle's popped off by now, I think. Anthony Quinn are the ones that make it to the boat and head back to the guns. And everyone escapes and gets out. So we have the survivors. Oh, sorry, spoilers. Gregory Peck, David Niven, Maria and Anthony Quinn, who are now a couple. Anthony Quinn decides he's not going to kill Gregory Peck after all. That's not really... heavily dealt with, is it? It's just sort of as we expect.
One might get a certain feeling of you were part of the reason my wife got killed, but now I have a new wife, so I'm happy again. I don't think that's what they intend, but it kind of feels that way.
It does sort of feel that, yeah, so it's all right. I filled my wife-shaped hole. That is the Guns of Navarone. I had never seen it before. I had a very good time with it, I have to say. When you're in the right mood for it, it goes along at a fair old lick.
Yeah, it's 157 minutes, but it does not, to me at least, feel slow.
No, it doesn't, no. It lays out what the plot is, what's going on, you know the characters. It's a little cliched, well, it's very cliched, but in the sense that...
to some extent, of course, that may be because the world and his dog copied.
Yes, I think partly it is... They're not supposed to be three-dimensional characters, particularly their archetypes in a lot of ways. And yes, partially, it was very successful. There was a sequel. Which I've never seen either.
So the book was 1957 and this is 61. The sequel book, which is 68, is more of a sequel to the film than it is to the actual book.
Okay, yes, yeah, that sort of thing. Like, I think Jaws 2 had a similar thing.
And then Force 10 was filmed in 78. as a completely different story, and MacLean effectively wrote that up as a different book.
Okay, but still with Gregory Peck, I believe.
I believe he's in the film now. I haven't seen it.
No, I won't be rushing to it. I would like to see more Alice Guest. I think if you're in the mood for these, it's basically an action adventure with just enough character depth to move it along and just enough sort of interest to keep it. What do I mean by that? Just slightly more depth, slightly more thoughtful character. I think there's enough thoughtful characters there that I care about them, I'm interested. We've got Nazis as baddies, which is always helpful.
It's that convenient thing of, this is World War II, you know this setting, we don't need to explain who's who.
Yes, yeah. Nicely done. Okay.
And well, then we'll move on to 1968 and Where Eagles Dare.
Where Eagles Dare. And this is it's sort of an interesting kind of mess. In fact, you still can't quite believe you're seeing kind of Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood sort of together. It just doesn't, there's some kind of dissonance there that doesn't quite work. So Richard Burton is, it's probably through his mega star phase by 68.
I think this could be characterized as his four bottles of vodka a day phase. Right, and yes. And while filming, he disappeared for several days with Peter O'Toole, Oliver Reed, Trevor Howard and Richard Harris.
Jesus.
And nobody knew where they were because they were getting pissed in some low dive somewhere.
God, blimey. Okay. In many ways, the more professional Clint is. So Clint Eastwood is not an unknown. He looks incredibly young. They're actually very similar ages, bizarrely, but I guess one of them's getting through four bottles of vodka.
Yeah, he's known at this point primarily for the westerns, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
I like the thing Sergio Leone said about him, which is he only has two expressions: with the hat, without the hat.
Which is what you want for that. Laconic, I think, would be a kind of way of putting it.
But he specifically said that he found this plot far too complicated and wanted it less dialogue and his role simplified. And I guess he got that.
I think Richard Burton described it as, I do all the talking and he does all the killing. Which is about right as well. So, I mean, the plot here is that it's a fiddly one, talking about convoluted plots. So we begin in media res. They're on a plane over Austria.
Yeah, I have a thesis. Any film that starts with the camera following a plane is a good film.
I mean,
evidence, I bring in Dr. Strangelove.
Very good, very good. I shall have a think about that, but I think you may be right. We haven't done Dr. Strangelove. I was going to talk to you about that at some point. It opens with this, like, to me, this is just a film. Because we open with this World War II plane. Is that right? Is it an accurate World War II plane?
Yeah, it's one of the Junkers.
Over this spectacular Alp landscape, over the snow. And then it comes up with Where Eagles Dare in the kind of the Gothic, that's associated with kind of Bavaria, that kind of font, Where Eagles Dare. And then you get this, the soundtrack. I just love the soundtrack. Mm. Oh my God. And you know, you are in a film. And, then you have Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. It's just, I'm on board from here. It takes me right back to being a kid. As a kid, I had not really any understanding of what was happening for pretty much the whole film. And as an adult, I'm not far off that either, but it is spectacular opening to a film. So it turns out this is a group of infiltrators, and we'd sort of told this in flashback.
Which is an interesting approach. I suspect that may be partly because of the whole, we don't want to have all the dialogue up front.
Yes, but we get it fairly, I mean, it sort of starts with it and then fairly quickly goes to the flashback as to what they're doing there. But what they're doing there basically is a captain... a Brigadier General, George Carnaby, was flying in the area. He was a chief planner for something about the Western Front, that he's got a major information about all the war plans, and they've captured him.
And he really shouldn't have been on that plane or in that place or any of these things.
No, why they do that, I don't know. But
they specifically call this out. He shouldn't have been there. The procedures but it don't turns allow out, it, but it seems he was anyway.
It's more complicated than that, of course. But the idea is they've got to get to this castle, Schloss Adler, the Castle of Eagles. And believe me, it's well named, because only an eagle can get to it. It's this giant Gothic fortress above this Bavarian... I'm going to mix up Bavarian and Austrian, but that kind of alpine town, snowy. And so the plan is they get up there, they get the Brigadier General, and they get him out. Because he's essential. Not only is he essential for the planning, if the Nazis grill him, the whole of the Western Front is in danger. So on the face of it, this seems like a fairly simple plot, much like the Guns of Navarone. But it gets a bit complicated than that. Pretty quickly, I haven't mentioned the other members of the team, other than Burton and Eastwood. Smith. I can't remember what Eastwood's name is.
They're all top men.
They're all
top.
Schaefer.
Because he's not going to play anything other than American, let's face it.
I think, is he Canadian in this? I wonder why he's Canadian particularly. Or am I imagining that?
I don't think so.
No, okay, maybe I imagine that. Because he's very
US Army Ranger, I think.
Oh, right, yes, he's a Ranger. So they're all... I think they're special forces of some kind. I don't know what sort of special forces existed at that time.
And we'll come back to this. But basically, it's a variety of nasty, sneaky fighting types.
They don't really have a thing so much, this lot, other than Richard Burton is the talky one. and Clint Eastwood's the shooty one. The others don't have much of a thing, but that becomes quite apparent quite quickly. Why not? It's because as soon as they land, one of them breaks his neck in the parachute fall, so they parachute out. They get to the... But already we see something's up. Smith, on the basis of going out to... Of course, he's going out to do a pee or something, but what he's actually doing is going out to meet his other contact in the woodshed, who happens to be Mary Ure, who is a Bavarian, Austrian. No, she's British. She's a British operative too, but they all speak German. This film has a very peculiar approach to how people speak German. I prefer the lower approach.
I should just say, she was jumping from the plane, and the rest of them didn't know she was in the plane.
Yes, she lets them all fall out and then she jumps out later. So there's clearly some other plot because Smith and Mary are romantically involved straight away. They already know each other and there's something else going on. And Smith goes back and checks the body and does he take a code book from the body?
He does, but he later claims he didn't because he uses that as an excuse to sneak off again later.
That's right, yes. But he's clearly a bit suspicious. There's more than just an unfortunate parachute accident. They start heading towards the town. And now this town is absolutely crawling with Nazis, completely crawling with it. Are they setting up? No, they do that later. So they walk over to the town. They've got a load of German units. In fact, they're already wearing German military uniforms as they land. The castle is spectacular. It is in Austria in real life. Festung Hohenwerfen,
yeah.
I'd love to see that in real life. But it is spectacular. Whether the town is there at the bottom, I don't know. But there's this huge cable car, which will come into it later. But they enter this kind of good old Bierfest kind of situation. We get the real baddie Nazi. I think he's introduced at this time. He's a Gestapo officer, Major von Harpen or something like that. But he meets and is attracted to Mary, which becomes a problem later on. The plot is,
played incidentally by Darren Nesbitt, who was interviewed by the Jewish Chronicle and asked, "How can you play Nazis?" And he said, "I do it because I play them very badly."
Yes, you play them. The way you do it is play them as an absolute shit. And he does a very good absolute shit here. He looks very Aryan as well. So, he certainly looks the type for it.
And he, of course, fancies Mary.
He, of course, fancies Mary. So the plan is... this is where it starts to get a bit confusing. They're going to get up to the castle. They don't seem to have a great plan, particularly, other than they're going to... Well, they're going to sort of get
Mary is brought in separately as a servant.
Yeah, so she goes up legitimately.
Who is Ingrid Pitt?
Yes, Ingrid Pitt is in here. And they, so we have, these two are sent up ahead. Well, she already works at the castle, and she has hired on her cousin. I think she's not her cousin, but that's the cover story. So she goes on up ahead, and then our heroes get up there by, taking the cable car, but jumping off it because they can't go into the main building, except we've already lost quite a few of the...
Well, hang on though, most of them, they're captured in the tavern.
Yes. So we're down to just,
Because another officer turns up and basically says, we're searching for deserters, everybody show us your ID. Smith realizes he's obviously searching for us.
Yes.
And said, right, well, we will surrender. So three of them are taken to the castle straight away, but Smith and Schaefer manage to escape.
Yes, so I think this is probably where, I don't think they discuss it particularly, this is probably where their original plan has gone a bit tits up, so they try and improvise. So they get into the cable car place.
Who is to say what was the original plan in the mind of the master planner?
But somehow the alarm's not raised, they get halfway up, they jump off, and then they climb up the wall of the castle, into the room where our two, where Ingrid Pitt and Mary Yor are. And it's basically, it's quite fun though, he's just like,
The more one recounts it, the more silly it sounds.
Doesn't it? But, I can't imagine, because they're just clambering, there's no harness or anything. They're just literally climbing up a rope on the outside of the castle. Richard Burton does not look, I'm sorry to say, in physical shape to be able to handle that, but he does. He manages it. He gets through. Clint Eastwood makes it through as well. And from
I should point out that as part of his payment for this, Clint Eastwood was given a Norton P11 racing bike.
Oh, was he?
Okay. And casually bogged off to Brad's Hatch with Ingrid Pitt.
Wow. So he was off doing that. Burton was off drinking with Richard Harris and
Reed.
Thank you. Not Oliver Cromwell.
And Peter O'Toole and Trevor Howard. I mean, no liver gets out alive.
I'm surprised David Niven wasn't there. He's probably doing something else at that point. So from this point on, it does get really quite confusing. So we see the captain... the Brigadier General is now to be interrogated by the Commandant of the castle of Schloss Adler.
And the three still captured commandos are there as well.
Yes. The Gestapo officer, Major von Harpen, has taken out Mary Yor for a drink, and his suspicions are a bit aroused. He's one of those characters that just makes you nervous anyway. He seems suspicious even when he's being nice. But there is some suspicion that he feels there's been some infiltration here. Anyway, during the interrogation, Smith and Schaefer pop up. And this is possibly one of the most confusing scenes of anything I've ever seen. But it turns out that Smith identifies himself now as a double agent, rings someone that he knows, he's Major Schmidt.
Well, shall we go through the things in order? Revelation one is that those three guys who got captured are all in fact German agents.
Yes. So they were, and
then yes. Smith and Schaefer come in. Smith tells Schaefer to surrender his weapon and says, I'm a bigger double agent.
I'm an even more double agent than they are.
I will prove it to you by giving you the name of Germany's top spy in Whitehall. And they look at it and that's him. You can prove it by telling me who the agents are that you've set up across Britain.
Yes, please all fill in these notebooks. it's so bizarre. So he makes them, in an effort to prove who they are, fill a notebook with all of the agents working in Britain. And while they're doing that, he then reveals, have we had Revelation 3, which is that the Brigadier General is not the Brigadier General at all. He's an actor called Casey Smith or something like that, or Casey Jones. He's an actor. He's not the real. He's been set up. The whole thing was a con. And that it turns out the whole... Okay. So then our Gestapo chap comes in and messes up the whole situation.
That does get shot, so, you know.
But
that.
Gets shot. I can't remember if it's Ingrid Pitt that shoots him. Well, it's probably Clint Eastwood. assuming that someone got shot, Clint Eastwood gets... Anyway, at the end of a confusing scene where even... I like that Clint Eastwood says, well, Colonel, you've got me about as confused as I ever hoped to be. But that, it turns out the whole point of this stupid mission... I'm not gonna... I love the film, I must admit, but this whole mission was to get these three... agents here, who they knew were German agents, to get into this bizarrely convoluted situation where they will write down the name of all the British agents in notebooks, so then they'll know everyone. And it turns out that Smith was just guessing who, I mean, they were pretty sure, but it was a guess, who was the chief German agent in Whitehall. And he wanted confirmation of that. So when he shows it to the Germans, like, oh yeah, that's him. Then he has done it. So now all they've got to do, having got their way into this incredibly impregnable fortress and got what they needed, surely there must have been an easier way of getting these names. But anyway, the whole point of the whole operation was to get these books of names. And now they've just got to get out alive. So from here on, it gets less confusing because basically they've just got to escape. The rest of the film is, it's great fun, but it is largely Clint Eastwood shooting hundreds and hundreds of Germans. like there's a corridor scene where he holds off, it's like 20 people, I think, by himself. They're throwing grenades in and he's throwing them back and he's just popping out. He does, the thing he does, you can tell he's exerting himself slightly, is he blinks a lot. You know, when he's pulling the trigger, he does a lot of blinking. So you can see that is the thing where he's very focused. It's good. I mean, what did you think of the chemistry between Burton and Eastwood? How did it work for you?
What chemistry? they are pointing in the same direction, was the impression I got.
Yeah, I mean, they're so different that I agree. There's no kind of warmth particularly, but it works for me as a kind of camaraderie kind of... I like both. I've always liked Richard Burton.
I find Eastwood most convincing at the point where he is... he may just be acting that he thinks that Burton has betrayed him.
Yes, yeah, that kind of look of a...
But there's an effective look of surprise.
Yes, and then kind of resentment, yeah. And then confusion. we go through all those emotions. Then they fight their way out. They want to take the agents with them, if they can. But turns out that they are less worried about that than disposing of them if they have to. So one of them rather cruelly, they get him climbing out of the rope down the side of the castle, and then they think, oh no, this is a crap plan, and they move to a different room, and he's shot to death while climbing down the building. There is a spectacular fight atop a cable car, this is the bit I always remember, this fight with, it's one of Richard Burton's few action scenes where he's having to fight, the one of the last, double agents on top of the cable car. It triggered my fear of heights. It's led to all manner of problems in my life, but I enjoyed that sequence very well. I mean, it's the whole point of this ridiculous plot is to give us a series of spectacular action sequences,
And with that in mind, I'd like to divert slightly into some corners.
Yes.
Specifically, aviation corner. You really don't have helicopters. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I know very little about aviation. I don't have a corner. But there is a moment when it looks like it's just flown off Magnum PI and landed.
Yeah,
it's
a Bell 47, and that model was actually introduced in 46, which is not bad going. But it's the 47G with that soap bubble canopy that everybody used on TV shows, as you say, wasn't introduced till 53. the thing is, there actually are, technically speaking, there are some early helicopters at this point. But, and they look gorgeous. They're dual intermeshing rotor. They haven't invented collective pitch yet, so all your pitch control is replaced by throttle control. They are a complete pig to fly.
God, okay.
I don't know if any survived the war, but they didn't survive much longer.
Okay.
And it would have been lovely to see one of those, but frankly, only people like me would have said, ooh, it's one of them. So,
But I do say...
The key thing is, though, that any helicopter would be, oh, wow, what's that? It's not
it
just,
looks
oh,
incongruous.
Look, it's
it doesn't, yeah. It does spoil the set of it, because everyone else, to me, looks authentic, everything else. But this helicopter looks so clearly anachronistic. This is the helicopter that lands in the centre of Schloss Adler with, I think it's the Commandant and possibly the Gestapo officer as well. Which Clint Eastwood later on blows up, obviously.
Obviously. As for the firearms corner, they are mostly using MP40s, which is plausible for the era. Yep, fair enough, I'll give them that. Probably there should be more Cal 98Ks among the troops, given that they're not frontliners, but, yeah. You don't use an MP40 one-handed.
Clint Eastwood does.
You also use the stock, that's why it's there.
I'm surprised he didn't do one in each hand at some point.
Yeah, granted. The thing that really threw me, though, was the explosives. They have these very convenient packs of presumably dynamite sticks with a clockwork timer and a tripwire thing already built into them. And they just didn't have explosives that convenient.
Oh, see, in my head, that is the stuff. If I think of an explosive, I think of those. That is what I think of as...
What they would actually use for time pencils was usually, for time fuses was time pencils, which is basically a chemical fuse. You snap the tube and the chemicals mix, and after a certain time, it will ignite.
Okay, so it's predictable, but not super predictable.
Also, you have a table in this. I've seen this table of temperature compensations.
Oh God, yes. You might want to do that when you're in the Alps. It's interesting. It reminds me of the Guns of Navarone where David Niven's character goes into some, at least to me, plausible explanations of how the explosives work and why this isn't going to work.
There certainly are tripwires, but they usually fire a flare or something like that. But anyway. The thing I would like to come back to Ingrid Pitt for obvious reasons, but also, she makes any film better as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
She is the one person in this crew who had actually lived under Nazism.
Oh, blimey, okay.
As a young girl, she was in a Polish concentration camp with her mother, and they escaped.
God, okay.
So if she's bringing a little extra edge to it, maybe that's why.
I mean, they're good. Their characters are, again, pretty thin, Mary and Ingrid Pitt's character, but they're basically the kind of the epitome of the heroic. I know they're not French, but they're like the French resistant fighter that are competent, serious, efficient. They're kind of archetypes, but they're very good at it.
And here's a thing you don't see in films very often anymore: an intermission.
Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah, sometimes they bring them back self-consciously.
It's about the two-thirds mark, which...
It's an odd place to do that. I was a bit thrown by that, but it was I did need the toilet, so it worked out all right. So at the bottom of the cable car, they get a school bus with a snowplow on the front, and they quickly run ahead and set up some explosives over the bridge. They hadn't done this previously, had they? Presumably, because anyone who drove over it would have set off the explosives.
Yeah.
I think they do it quickly, escape. So they get back on loads of things blow up.
They use the snowplow on the front of the bus to wreck
trigger
the fighters
these tripwires. Oh yes, they wreck the fighters.
T-6 Texans on loan from the Austrian Air Force.
So they basically destroy an entire airport without wrecking the runway. The Junkers lands on the runway. Everyone gets on board. But there is one last twist, because it turns out that the main German agent...
The chief agent.
Yes. Is the one who sent them on the mission in the first... Oh, we had Michael Horden. I didn't mention Michael Horden. It's always nice to see
him. Yeah, I've always loved Michael Horden's voice. I first met him reading M.R. James' Ghost Stories.
Oh, that would be beautiful. I met him as I used to listen to the audio version of Lord of the Rings, Brian Sibley's production, and he's Gandalf. And so to me, Michael Horden is Gandalf. So I know Ian McKellen's a very good Gandalf, but he's not Michael Horden.
And of course, we've seen him in Room of Mies before because he's in Theatre of Blood.
Oh, he is, yes, yeah, briefly. Anyway, lovely team here. But it turns out that the captain, Patrick Weimark, I think, I've originally born Patrick Cheeseman. Why you would not keep a name like Cheeseman, I don't know, but there we go.
Anyway, yeah.
He's one of those actors that you probably don't know the name, but you do recognise if you watch films around this period. He does crop up in a reasonable amount of film. Anyway, he's got, and again, this is one of those scenes that is indelibly printed on my mind with him going, as Richard Burton Smith reveals that he knows what he's going to do, and he's going to get hanged when he gets back to Britain. And so there's this line of dialogue where he's like, do I have an alternative? And Richard Burton sort of glances at the door of the plane. He's like, if you want it. And so he has to, Roy jumps out of the plane, kills himself. And then they fly off into the distance and the beautiful, I'm going to look up the name, Ron Goodwin composed the soundtrack and it's bloody great. I love it. It does exactly what he wants to do. So I think, so it's a needlessly complicated film, rather silly. I love Richard Burton. I like Clint Eastwood. I agree they don't quite gel together. For me, it's sort of tinged with a lot of nostalgia. I think having watched the two together, I probably would say objectively The Guns of Navarone is a better film. Probably. Mm. Maybe. But this one's spectacular. I don't know. The plot makes more sense in The Guns of Navarone. But I personally, I think they're both great. They're just really fun.
The novel of this one, by the way, is, I would say, more humorous, definitely less violent, and a bit more romantic.
You know,
Schaefer and, what's her name? Heidi. End up together as well.
Oh, well, that's nice.
I mean, obviously that requires Schaefer's personality.
he's quite laconic, as you say. I wouldn't say he does a lot of acting here. Richard Burton's voice just works for me. I really enjoy both these films. Are they masterpieces? But in a way, they're exactly what films should be, in that they're larger than life, they're very bright, you know, the colours, particularly in Where Eagles Dare, are quite striking, the scenery's striking, the music's, I don't know, what I want out of a film is quite often what I get out of these films, really, just a good time for 2 hours. We've talked about this before, I'm not generally looking for deep thought from a film, maybe this is our failing, and when films try and do that, sometimes it works for me, quite often it just irritates me. I'm happier reading philosophy or novels or something.
Yeah, I do generally find a book does the serious stuff better.
Yes.
That said, you know, there have been exceptions. See previous episodes, dash it off.
Yes, yeah, there are some we have been thoughtful about. And similarly, would you recommend giving him a read, Alistair MacLean? I would be tempted after this.
Yes, though I would say, A, put yourself in the right sort of mood for it, as with the films.
Yes.
B, probably, if you have a high tolerance for actual war stories, then start at the beginning with HMS Ulysses. Otherwise, skip over that one and go to the more explicitly fictional.
Okay.
Because HMS Ulysses is very much written from the life. But also, if you find that you're not enjoying them as much, then they probably ain't going to get better again. So stop there, rather than plowing on through.
All right. I'll give them a try. I will certainly give some a try. It's probably a good thing we didn't double bill this with Schindler's List or The Pianist. But for what they are, which has, to me, they're film versions of Commando Comic. Better, I found the Commando Comics pretty racist and quite quite poorly plotted in a lot of areas. But I feel like what they were trying to mimic was these sorts of films, and I think they did.
Yeah, we keep saying, or at least I keep saying, that it's not fair to blame a film for not being what I wanted it to be.
Yes.
And if you know, you should know in advance what sort of film this is, and it does that sort of film very well. They both do.
Yes, if I heard, oh, there's a new Alistair MacLean war film, I'll go and watch that at the cinema, I would come out thinking like, oh, perfect, that was exactly what I wanted, that was good. I feel a bit happy from the horror of our current existence.
And thank goodness we won't have to deal with Nazis ever again.
Now I'm sad again.